He said he wanted me to drive, Weiser told him as he carefully turned his car around at the entrance to the gravel pit. Where to? Lois asked. She was sitting in the back with Dorrance. Ralph was in the front seat with Joe Weiser, who looked as if he weren't quite sure where or even who he was. Ralph had slid up just the tiniest bit as he shook hands with the pharmacist, wanting to get a look at Weiser's aura. Both it and his balloon string were there, and both looked perfectly healthy. But the bright yellow-orange looked slightly muted to him. Ralph had an idea that was very likely old Dawes' influence. Good question, Weiser said. He voiced a small, confused laugh. I don't have the slightest idea, really. This has been the weirdest day of my entire life. Absolutely no doubt about it. The woods road ended in a T-junction with a stretch of two-lane blacktop. Weiser stopped, looked for traffic, then turned left. They passed a sign reading to I-95 almost right away, and Ralph guessed that Weiser would turn north as soon as they reached the turnpike. He knew where they were now, just about 2 miles south of Route 33. From here they could be back in Derry in less than half an hour, and Ralph had no doubt that was just where they were going. He abruptly began to laugh. Well, here we are, he said. Just three happy folks out for a midday drive. Make that four. Welcome to the wonderful world of hyperreality, Joe. Joe gave him a sharp look, then relaxed into a grin. Is that what this is? And before either Ralph or Lois could reply, yeah, I suppose it is. Did you read that poem? Dorrance asked from behind Ralph. The one that starts, each thing I do, I rush through so I can do something else. Ralph turned and saw that Dorrance was still smiling his wide, placid smile. Yes, I did, Dor. Isn't it a crackerjack? It's so good. Stephen Dobbins reminds me of Hart Crane, without the pretensions. Or maybe I mean Stephen Crane, but I don't think so. Of course, he doesn't have the music of Dylan Thomas, but is that so bad? Probably not. Modern poetry is not about music. It's about nerve. Who has it and who doesn't? Oh, boy, Lois said. She rolled her eyes. He could probably tell us everything we need to know if we went up a few levels, Ralph said. But you don't want that, do you, Dor? Because time goes faster when you're high. Bingo, Dorrance replied. The blue signs marking the north and south entrances to the turnpike glimmered up ahead. You'll have to go up later, I imagine. You and Lois both. So it's very important to save as much time as you can now. Save time. He made a queerly evocative gesture, drawing a gnarled thumb and forefinger down in the air, bringing them together as he did, as if to indicate some narrowing passage. Joe Weiser put on his blinker, turned left, and headed down the northbound ramp to Derry. How did you get involved in this, Joe? Ralph asked him. Of all the people on the west side, why did Dorrance draft you as chauffeur? Weiser shook his head, and when the car reached the turnpike, it drifted immediately over into the passing lane. Ralph reached out quickly and made a mid-course correction, reminding himself that Joe probably hadn't been getting much sleep himself just lately. He was very happy to see the highway was mostly deserted, at least this far out of town. It would save some anxiety, and God knew he would take whatever he could get in that department today. "We are all bound together by the purpose," Dorrance said abruptly. "That's Kat-Tit, which means one made of many. The way that many rhymes make up a single poem, you see?" "No." Ralph, Lois, and Joe said it at the same time in perfect, unrehearsed chorus, and then laughed nervously together. The three insomniacs of the apocalypse, Ralph thought. Jesus save us. "That's okay," old Dora said, smiling his wide smile. "Just take my word for it. You and Lois, Helen and her little daughter, Bill, Faye Chapin, Trigger Vashon, me, all part of the purpose." "That's fine, Dor," Lois said, "but Where's the purpose taking us now? And what are we supposed to do when we get there? Dorrance leaned forward and whispered in Joe Weiser's ear, guarding his lips with one puffy, age-spotted hand. Then he sat back again, looking deeply satisfied with himself.
He says we're going to the Civic Center, Joe said.
The Civic Center? Lois exclaimed, sounding alarmed. No, that can't be right. Those two little men said...
Never mind them right now, Doran said. Just remember what it's about. Nerve! Who has it and who doesn't?
Silence in Joe Weiser's Ford for almost the space of a mile. Dorrance opened his book of Robert Creeley poems and began to read one, tracing his way from line to line with the yellowed nail of one ancient finger. Ralph found himself remembering a game they had sometimes played as kids. Not a very nice one. Snipe hunt, it had been called. You got kids who were a little younger and a lot more gullible than you were. Fed them a cock and bull story about the mystical snipe. Then gave them toe sacks and sent them out to spend the strenuous afternoon wandering around in the damps and the willywags, looking for non-existent birds. This game was also called Wild Goose Chase, and he suddenly had the inescapable feeling that Clotho and Lachesis had been playing it with him and Lois up on the hospital roof. He turned around in his seat and looked directly at old Dor. Dorrance folded over the top corner of the page he was reading, closed his book, and looked back at Ralph with polite interest. They told us we weren't to go near either Ed Deepno or Doc Number 3, Ralph said. He spoke slowly and with great clarity. They told us very specifically that we weren't even to think of doing that, because the situation had invested both of them with great power, and we were apt to get swatted like flies. In fact, I think Lachesa said that if we tried getting near either Ed or Atropos, we might end up having a visit from one of the upper-level honchos. Someone Ed calls the Crimson King. Not a very nice fellow either, by all reports. Yes, Lois said in a faint voice. That's what they told us on the hospital roof. They said we had to convince the women in charge to cancel Susan Day's appearance. That's why we went out to High Ridge.
And did you succeed in convincing them? Weiser asked.
No. Ed's crazy friends came before we could get there, set the place on fire, and killed at least two of the women. Shot them. One was the woman we really wanted to talk to.
Gretchen Tilbury, Ralph said.
Yes, Lois agreed. But surely we don't need to do any more. I can't believe they'll go ahead with the rally now. I mean, how could they? My God, at least four people are dead, probably more. They'll have to cancel her speech, or at least postpone it. Isn't that so?
Neither Dorrance nor Joe replied.
Ralph didn't reply either. He was thinking of Helen's red-rimmed, furious eyes. How can you even ask? She'd said. If they stop us now, they win. If they stop us now, they win.
Was there any legal way the police could stop them?
Probably not. The city council, then?
Maybe. Maybe they could hold a special meeting and revoke Woman Care's rally permit.
But would they?
If there were 2,000 angry, grief-stricken women marching around the municipal building and yelling, "If they stop us now, they win," in unison, would the council revoke the permit?
Ralph began to feel a deep sinking sensation in his gut.
Helen clearly considered tonight's rally more important than ever, and she wouldn't be the only one. It was no longer just about choice and who had the right to decide what a woman did with her own body. Now it was about causes important enough to die for, and honoring the friends who had done just that. Now they were talking not just about politics, but about a kind of secular requiem mass for the dead.
Lois had grabbed his shoulder and was shaking it hard. Ralph came back to the here and now, but slowly, like a man being shaken awake in the middle of an incredibly vivid dream. They will cancel it, won't they? And even if they don't, if for some crazy reason they don't, most people will stay away, right? After what happened at High Ridge, they'll be afraid to come. Ralph thought about that and then shook his head. Most people will think the danger's over. The news reports are going to say that two of the radicals who attacked High Ridge are dead, and the third is catatonic or something.
But Ed, what about Ed? She cried. He's the one who got them to attack, for heaven's sake. He's the one who sent them out there in the first place.
That may be true. Probably is true. But how could we prove it? Do you know what I think the cops will find at wherever Charlie Pickering's been hanging his hat? A note saying it was all his idea. A note exonerating Ed completely, probably in the guise of an accusation. How Ed deserted them in their time of greatest need. And if they don't find a note like that in Charlie's rented room, they'll find it in Frank Felton's or Sandra McKay's.
But that's...
Lois stopped, biting at her lower lip. Then she looked at Weiser with hopeful eyes.
What about Susan Day? Where is she? Does anybody know? Do you? Ralph and I will call her on the telephone and...
She's already in Derry, Weiser said. Although I doubt if even the police know for sure where she is. But what I heard on the news while the old fella and I were driving out here is that the rally is going to happen tonight. And that's supposedly straight from the woman herself.
Sure, Ralph thought, sure it is. The show's going on. The show has to go on, and she knows it.
Someone who's ridden the crest of the women's movement all these years, held since the Chicago Convention in 68, knows a genuine watershed moment when she sees it. She's evaluated the risks and found them acceptable. Either that, or she's evaluated the situation and decided that the credibility loss involved in walking away would be unacceptable. Maybe both. In any case, she's as much a prisoner of events, of Catet, as the rest of us. They were on the outskirts of Derry again. Ralph could see the Civic Center on the horizon. Now it was old Dore Lois turned to.
Where is she? Do you know? It doesn't matter how many security people she's got around her. Ralph and I can be invisible when we want to be, and we're very good at changing people's minds.
Oh, changing Susan Day's mind wouldn't change anything, Dore said. He still wore that broad, maddening smile. They'll come to the Civic Center tonight, no matter what. If they come and find the doors locked, they'll break them open and go inside and have their rally just the same, to show they're not afraid.
Done, bun, can't be undone, Ralph said dully.
Right, Ralph, Dore said cheerily, and patted Ralph's arm.
5 minutes later, Joe drove his Ford past the hideous plastic statue of Paul Bunyan, which stood in front of the Civic Center, and turned in at a sign which read, "There's always free parking at your Civic Center." The acre of parking lot lay between the Civic Center building itself and the Bassey Park racetrack. If the event that evening had been a rock concert or a boat show or a wrestling card, they would have had the parking lot entirely to themselves this early. But tonight's event was clearly going to be light years from an exhibition basketball game or a monster truck pull. There were already 60 or 70 cars in the lot, and little groups of people standing around looking at the building. Most of them were women. Some had picnic hampers. Several were crying, and almost all wore black armbands. Ralph saw a middle-aged woman with a weary, intelligent face and a great mass of gray hair passing these out from a carry bag. She was wearing a T-shirt with Susan Day's face on it and the words, "We shall overcome." And where the O's were was the woman sign. The drive-through area in front of the Civic Center's bank of entrance doors was even busier than the parking lot. No fewer than 6 TV news vans were parked there, and various tech crews stood under the triangular cement canopy in little clusters, discussing how they were going to handle tonight's event. And according to the bedsheet banner which hung down from the canopy, flapping lazily in the breeze, there was going to be an event. "Rally is on," it read, in large, blurry spray paint letters. 8 p.m. Come show your solidarity. Express your outrage. Comfort your sisters. Joe put the Ford in park, then turned to old Dore, eyebrows raised. Dore nodded and Joe looked at Ralph. I guess this is where Hugh and Lois get out, Ralph. Good luck. I'd come with you if I could. I even asked him. But he says I'm not equipped.
That's all right, Ralph said. We appreciate everything you've done, don't we, Lois?
We certainly do, Lois said. Ralph reached for the door handle, then let it go again. He turned to face Dorrance.
What's this about? Really, I mean, it's not about saving the 2,000 or so people Clotho and Lachesa said are going to be here tonight, that's for sure. To the kind of all-time forces they talked about, 2,000 lives are probably just a little more grease on the bearings. So what's it all about, Alfie? Why are we here?
Dorrance's grin had faded at last. With it gone, he looked younger and strangely formidable.
Job asked God the same question, he said, and got no answer. You're not going to get one either. But I'll tell you this much. You've become the pivot point of great events and vast forces. The work of the higher universe has almost completely come to a stop as those of both the random and the purpose turn to mark your progress.
That's great, but I don't get it, Ralph said, more in resignation than in anger.
Neither do I. But those 2,000 lives are enough for me, Lois said quietly. I could never live with myself if I didn't at least try to stop what's going to happen. I dream of the death bag around that building for the rest of my life. Even if I only got an hour's sleep a night, I'd dream of it.
Ralph considered this, then nodded. He opened his door and swung one foot out.
That's a good point. And Helen will be there. She might even bring Nat. Maybe for short-time farts like us, that's enough.
And maybe, he thought, I want a rematch with Doc Number 3.
Oh, Ralph, Carolyn mourned. Clint Eastwood? Again?
No, not Clint Eastwood. Not Sylvester Stallone or Arnold Schwarzenegger either. Not even John Wayne. He was no big action hero or movie star. He was just plain old Ralph Roberts from Harris Avenue. That didn't make the grudge he bore the Doc with the rusty scalpel any less real, however. And now that grudge was a lot bigger than just a stray dog and the retired history teacher who had lived downstairs for the last 10 years or so. Ralph kept thinking of the parlor at High Ridge and the women propped against the wall below the poster of Susan Day. It wasn't upon Merrilee's pregnant belly which the eye in his mind kept focusing, but Gretchen Tilbury's hair. Her beautiful blonde hair that had been mostly burned off by the close-range rifle shot that had taken her life. Charlie Pickering had pulled the trigger, and maybe Ed Deepno had put the gun in his hands. But it was Atropos, Ralph blamed. Atropos, the jump rope thief. Atropos, the hat thief. Atropos, the comb thief. Atropos, the earring thief.
Come on, Lois, he said. Let's...
But she put her hand on his arm and shook her head. Not just yet. Get back in here and shut the door. He looked at her carefully, then did what she said. She paused, gathering her thoughts, and when she spoke, she looked directly at old Dora.
I still don't understand why we were sent out to High Ridge, she said. They never even came right out and said that was what we were supposed to do. But we know, don't we, Ralph, that that was what they wanted from us. And I want to understand. If we're supposed to be here, why did we have to go out there? I mean, we saved some lives, and I'm glad. But I think Ralph's right. A few lives don't mean much to the people running this show.
Silence for a moment, and then Doran said,
Did Clotho and Lachesis really strike you as all-wise and all-knowing, Lois?
Well, they were smart, but I guess they weren't exactly geniuses, she said after a moment's thought. At one point, they called themselves Working Joes, who were a long way down the ladder from the boardroom executives who actually made the decisions.
Old Dor was nodding and smiling. Clotho and Lachesis are almost short-timers themselves in the big scheme of things. They have their own fears and mental blind spots. They are also capable of making bad decisions. But in the end, that doesn't matter, because they also serve the purpose. And Katet.
They thought we'd lose if we went head-to-head with Atropos, didn't they? Ralph asked. That's why they talked themselves into believing we could accomplish what they wanted by using the back door. The back door being High Ridge.
Yes, Dor said. That's it.
Great, Ralph said. I love a vote of confidence, especially when...
No, Dor said. That's not it.
Ralph and Lois exchanged a bewildered glance.
What are you talking about?
It's both things at the same time. That's very often the way things are within the purpose. You see, well, he sighed, I hate all these questions. I hardly ever answer questions. Did I tell you that?
Yes, Lois said, you did.
Yes, and now, bingo, all these questions. Nasty and useless.
Ralph looked at Lois, and she looked back at him. Neither of them made any move to get out.
Dor heaved a sigh. All right, but this is the last thing I'm going to say, so pay attention. Clotho and Lachesis may have sent you to High Ridge for the wrong reasons, but the purpose sent you there for the right ones. You fulfilled your task there.
By saving the women, Lois said.
But Dorrance was shaking his head.
Then what did we do? She nearly shouted. What? Don't we have a right to know what part of the gosh-damned purpose we fulfilled?
No, Dorrance said. At least not yet, because you have to do it again.
This is crazy, Ralph said.
It isn't, though, Dorrance replied. He was holding For Love tightly against his chest now, bending it back and forth and looking at Ralph earnestly.
Random is crazy. Purpose is sane.
All right, Ralph thought. What did we do at High Ridge besides save the people in the cellar?
And John Lydecker, of course. I think Pickering might have killed him as well as Chris Nell if I hadn't intervened.
Could it be something to do with Lydecker?
He supposed it could, but it didn't feel right. Dorrance, he said, can't you please give us a little more information? I mean...
No,
old Dor said, not unkindly. No more questions, no more time. We'll have a good meal together after this is over. If we're still around, that is.
You really know how to cheer a fellow up, Dor.
Ralph opened his door. Lois did the same, and they both stepped out into the parking lot. He bent down and looked at Joe Weiser. Is there anything else? Anything you can think of?
No, I don't think.
Dor leaned forward and whispered in his ear. Joe listened, frowning.
Well? Ralph asked when Doran sat back.
What did he say?
He said not to forget my comb, Joe said.
I don't have the slightest idea of what he's talking about.
But what else is new?
That's okay, Ralph said and smiled a little. It's one of the few things I do understand.
Come on, Lois. Let's check out the crowd. Mingle a little.
Halfway across the parking lot, she elbowed him so hard in the side that Ralph staggered.
Look, she whispered. Right over there. Isn't that Connie Chung?
Ralph looked. Yes. The woman in the beige coat standing between two techs with the CBS logo on their jackets was almost certainly Connie Chung. He'd admired her pretty, intelligent face and pleasant smile over too many evening meals to have much doubt about it. Either her or her twin sister, he said. Lois seemed to have forgotten all about Old Dor and High Ridge and the Bald Docks. In that moment, she was once more the woman Bill McGovern had liked to call our Lois.
I'll be darned. What's she doing here?
Well, Ralph began and then covered his mouth to hide a jaw-cracking yawn.
I guess what's going on in Derry is national news now. She must be here to do a live segment in front of the Civic Center for tonight's news.
In any case, suddenly, with no warning at all, the auras swam back. Ralph gasped.
Jesus! Lois, are you seeing this?
But he didn't think she was.
If she had been,
Ralph didn't think Connie Chung would have rated even an honorable mention on Lois's attention roster. This was horrible, almost beyond conceiving, and for the first time, Ralph fully realized
that even the bright world of auras had its dark side, one that would make an ordinary person fall on his knees and thank God for his reduced perceptions. And this isn't even stepping up the ladder, he thought. At least I don't think it is. I'm only looking at that wider world, like a man looking through a window. I'm not actually in it. Nor did he want to be in it. Just looking at something like this was almost enough to make you wish you were blind. Lois was frowning at him. What, the colors? No. Should I try to? Is there something wrong with them? He tried to answer and couldn't. A moment later, he felt her hand seize his arm in a painful pincer's grip above the elbow and knew that no explanation was necessary. For better or worse, Lois was now seeing for herself. Oh, dear, she whimpered in a breathless little voice that teetered on the edge of tears. Oh, dear. Oh, dear. Oh, jeez, Louise. From the roof of Derry Home, the aura hanging over the Civic Center had looked like a vast, saggy umbrella. The Travelers Insurance Company logo colored black by a child's crayon, perhaps. Standing here in the parking lot, it was like being inside a large and indescribably nasty mosquito net, one so old and badly cared for that its gauzy walls had silted up with blackish green mildew. The bright October sun shrank to a bleary circle of tarnished silver. The air took on a gloomy, foggy cast that made Ralph think of pictures of London at the end of the 19th century. They were not just looking at the Civic Center death bag. Not anymore. They were buried alive in it. Ralph could feel it pressing hungrily in on him, trying to overwhelm him with feelings of loss and despair and dismay. Why bother? He asked himself, watching apathetically as Joe Wise's Ford drove back down toward Main Street with old Dor still sitting in the back seat. I mean, hey, really, what the hell is the use? We can't change this thing. No way we can. Maybe we did something out at High Ridge, but the difference between what was going on out there and what's happening here is like the difference between a smudge and a black hole. If we try to mess in with this business, we're going to get flattened. He heard moaning from beside him and realized Lois was crying. Mustering his flagging energy, he slid an arm around her shoulders. Hold on, Lois, he said. We can stand up to this. But he wondered. We're breathing it in, she wept. It's like we're sucking up death. Oh, Ralph, let's get away from here. Please, let's just get away from here. The idea sounded as good to him as the idea of water must sound to a man dying of thirst in the desert. But he shook his head. 2,000 people are going to die here tonight if we don't do something. I'm pretty confused about the rest of this business, but that much I can grasp with no trouble at all. Okay, she whispered. Just keep your arm around me so I don't crack my head open if I faint. It was ironic, Ralph thought. They now had the faces and bodies of people in the early years of a vigorous middle age. But they shuffled across the parking lot like a pair of old-timers, whose muscles have turned to string and whose bones have turned to glass. He could hear Lois's breathing, rapid and labored, like the breathing of a woman who has just sustained some serious injury. I'll take you back if you want, Ralph said, and he meant it. He would take her back to the parking lot. He would take her to the orange bus stop bench he could see from here. And when the bus came, getting on and going back to Harris Avenue would be the simplest thing in the world. He could feel the killer aura which surrounded this place pressing in on him, trying to smother him like a plastic dry-cleaning bag. And he found himself remembering something McGovern had said about Mailocker's emphysema, that it was one of those diseases that keep on giving. And now he supposed he had a pretty good idea of how Mailocker had felt during her last few years. It didn't matter how hard he sucked at the black air or how deep he dragged it down. It did not satisfy. His heart and head went on pounding, making him feel as if he was suffering the worst hangover of his life. He was opening his mouth to repeat that he'd take her back when she spoke up, talking in little out-of-breath gasps. I guess I can make it. but I hope it won't take long. Ralph, how come we can feel something this bad even without being able to see the colors? Why can't they? She pointed at the media people milling around the Civic Center. Are we short-timers that insensitive? I hate to think that. He shook his head, indicating that he didn't know. But he thought that perhaps the news crews, video technicians, and security guards clustered around the doors and beneath the spray-painted banner hanging from the canopy did feel something. He saw lots of hands holding styrofoam cups of coffee, but he didn't see anyone actually drinking the stuff. There was a box of donuts sitting on the hood of a station wagon, but the only one which had been taken out had been laid aside on a napkin, with just a single bite gone. Ralph ran his eye over 24 faces without seeing a single smile. The news people were going about their work, setting camera angles, marking locations from which the talking heads would do their stand-ups, laying down coaxial cable and duct-taping it to the cement. But they were doing it without the sort of excitement which Ralph would have expected to accompany a story as big as this one was turning out to be. Connie Chung walked out from beneath the canopy with a bearded, handsome cameraman. Michael Rosenberg, the tag on his CBS jacket said, and then raised her small hands in a framing gesture, showing him how she wanted him to shoot the bedsheet banner hanging down from the canopy. Rosenberg nodded. Chung's face was pale and solemn, and at one point during her conversation with the bearded cameraman, Ralph saw her pause and raise a hand uncertainly to her temple, as if she had lost her train of thought or perhaps felt faint. There seemed to be an underlying similarity to all the expressions he saw, a common chord, and he thought he knew what it was. They were all suffering from what had been called melancholia when he was a kid, and melancholia was just a fancy word for the blues. Ralph found himself remembering times in his life when he'd hit the emotional equivalent of a cold spot while swimming, or clear air turbulence while flying. You'd be cruising along through your day, sometimes feeling great, sometimes just feeling okay, but getting along and getting it done. And then, for no apparent reason at all, you'd go down in flames and crash. A sense of, what the hell's the use, would slide over you, unconnected to any real event in your life at that moment, but incredibly powerful all the same. And you felt like simply creeping back to bed and pulling the covers up over your head. Maybe this is what causes feelings like that, he thought. Maybe it's running into something like this, some big mess of death or sorrow waiting to happen, spread out like a banquet tent made of cobwebs and tears instead of canvas and rope. We don't see it, not down on our short-time level, but we feel it. Oh, yes, we feel it. And now it was trying to suck them dry. Maybe they weren't vampires, as they both had feared, but this thing was. The death bag had a sluggish, half-sentient life, and it would suck them dry if it could, if they let it. Lois stumbled against him, and Ralph had all he could do to keep them both from sprawling to the pavement. Then she lifted her head, slowly, as if her hair had been dipped in cement, curled a hand around her mouth, and inhaled sharply. At the same time, she flickered a little. Under other circumstances, Ralph might have dismissed that flicker as a momentary glitch in his own eyes, but not now. She had slid up just a little, just enough to feed. He hadn't seen Lois dip into the waitress's aura, but this time everything happened in front of him. The auras of the news people were like small but brightly colored Japanese lanterns, glowing bravely in a vast, gloomy cavern. Now a tight beam of violet gray speared out from one of them, from Michael Rosenberg, Connie Chung's bearded cameraman, in fact. It divided in two an inch or so in front of Lois's face. The upper branch divided in two again and slipped into her nostrils. The lower branch went between her parted lips and into her mouth. He could see it glowing faintly behind her cheeks, lighting her from the inside as a candle lights a jack-o'-lantern. Her grip on him loosened, and suddenly the leaning pressure of her weight was gone. A moment later, the violet beam of light disappeared. She looked around at him. Color, not a lot, but some, was returning to her leaden cheeks. That's better. A lot better. Now you, Ralph. He was reluctant. It still felt like stealing, but it had to be done if he didn't want to simply collapse right here. He could almost feel the last of Nirvana Boy's borrowed energy running out through his pores. He curled his hand around his mouth now, as he had in the Dunkin' Donuts parking lot that morning, and turned slightly to his left, seeking a target. Connie Chung had backed several steps closer to them. She was still looking up at the bedsheet banner hanging from the canopy, and talking to Rosenberg, who seemed none the worse for wear as a result of Lois's borrowing, about it. With no further thought, Ralph inhaled sharply through the curled tube of his fingers. Chung's aura was the same lovely shade of wedding gown ivory as those which had surrounded Helen and Nat on the day they'd come to his apartment with Gretchen Tilbury. Instead of a ray of light, something like a long straight ribbon shot from Chung's aura. Ralph felt strength begin to fill him almost at once, banishing the aching weariness in his joints and muscles. And he could think clearly again, as if a big cloud of sludge had just been washed out of his brain. Connie Chung broke off, looked up at the sky for a moment, then began to talk to the cameraman again. Ralph glanced around and saw Lois looking at him anxiously. "Any better?" she whispered. "All kinds," he said. "But it's still like being zipped up in a body bag." "I think," Lois began, and then her eyes fixed on something to the left of the Civic Center doors. She screamed and shrank back against Ralph, her eyes so wide it seemed they must tumble from their sockets. He followed her gaze and felt his breath stop in his throat. The planners had tried to soften the building's plain brick sides by planting evergreen bushes along them. These had either been neglected or purposely allowed to grow until they interlaced and threatened to entirely hide the narrow strip of grass between them and the concrete walk which bordered the drive-thru. Giant bugs that looked like prehistoric trilobites were squirming in and out of these evergreens in droves, crawling over each other, bumping heads, sometimes rearing up and pawing each other with their front legs like stags locking horns during mating season. They weren't transparent, like the bird on the satellite dish, but there was something ghostly and unreal about them just the same. Their auras flickered feverishly, and brainlessly, Ralph guessed, through a whole spectrum of colors. They were so bright and yet so ephemeral that it was almost possible to think of them as weird lightning bugs. Except that's not what they are. You know what they are. "Hey!" It was Rosenberg, Chung's cameraman, who hailed them, but most of the others in front of the building were looking. "She okay, bud?" "Yes," Ralph called back. He still had his hand curled around his mouth and lowered it quickly, feeling foolish. "She just..." "I saw a mouse," Lois called, smiling a Daffy dazed smile, and our Lois smile if Ralph had ever seen one. He was very proud of her. She pointed toward the evergreen shrubs to the left of the door with a finger that was almost steady. He went right in there. Gosh, but he was a fat one. Did you see him, Norton?"
"No, Alice."
"Stick around, lady," Michael Rosenberg called. "You'll see all kinds of wildlife here tonight." There was some desultory, almost forced laughter, and then they turned back to their tasks. "God, Ralph," Lois whispered. Those things." He took a hand and squeezed it.
"Steady, Lois."
"They know, don't they? That's why they're here. They're like vultures."
Ralph nodded.
As he watched, several bugs emerged from the tops of the bushes and began to ooze aimlessly up the wall. They moved with dazed sluggishness, like flies buzzing against a window pane in November, and left slimy trails of color behind them. These quickly dimmed and faded. Other bugs crawled out from beneath the bushes and onto the small strip of lawn. One of the local news commentators began strolling toward this infested area, and when he turned his head,
Ralph saw it was John Kirkland. He was talking to a good-looking woman dressed in one of those power-look business outfits, which Ralph found, under normal circumstances anyway, extremely sexy. He guessed she was Kirkland's producer, and wondered if Lisette Benson's aura turned green when this woman was around.
"They're going toward those bugs," Lois whispered fiercely at him. "We have to stop them, Ralph. We have to."
"We're not going to do a damn thing."
"But,
Lois, we can't start raving about bugs nobody but us can see. We'll end up in the nuthatch if we do. Besides, the bugs aren't there for them." He paused and added, "I hope."
They watched as Kirkland and his good-looking colleague walked onto the lawn and into a jelly-like knot of the twitching, crawling trilobites. One slid onto Kirkland's highly polished loafer, paused until he stopped moving for a second, then climbed onto his pants leg.
"I don't give much of a shit about Susan Day one way or the other," Kirkland was saying. "Woman cares the story here, not her. Crying babes wearing black armbands."
"Watch out, John," the woman said dryly.
"Your sensitivity is showing."
"Is it?
God damn."
The bug on his pants leg appeared bound for his crotch. It occurred to Ralph that if Kirkland was suddenly given the power to see what was shortly going to be crawling over his balls, he would probably go right out of his mind.
"Okay, but be sure to talk to the women who run the local power network," the producer was saying. "Now that Tilbury's dead, the ones that matter are Maggie Petrowski, Barbara Richards, and Dr. Roberta Harper. Harper's going to introduce the big kahuna tonight, I think. Or maybe in this case it's the big kahunette."
The woman took a step off the sidewalk, and one of her high heels skewered a lumbering color bug. A rainbow of guts spewed out of it, and a waxy white substance that looked like stale mashed potatoes. Ralph had an idea the white stuff had been eggs. Lois pressed her face against his arm.
"And keep your eyes open for a lady named Helen Deepnow," the producer said, taking a step closer to the building. The bug stuck on the heel of her shoe flopped and twisted as she walked.
"Deepnow," Kirkland said. He tapped his knuckles against his brow. "Somewhere deep inside, a bell is ringing."
"Nah, it's just your last active brain cell rolling around in there," the producer said. "She's Ed Deepnow's wife. They're separated. If you want tears, she's your best bet. She and Tilbury were good friends, maybe special friends, if you know what I mean."
Kirkland leered, an expression so foreign to his on-camera persona that Ralph felt slightly disoriented. One of the color bugs, meanwhile, had found its way onto the toe of the woman's shoe and was working its way up her leg. Ralph watched in helpless fascination as it disappeared beneath the hem of her skirt. Watching the moving bump climb her thigh was like watching a kitten under a bath towel. And again it seemed that Kirkland's colleague felt something. As she talked to him about interviews during Day's speech, she reached down and absently scratched at the lump, which had now made it almost all the way up to her right hip. Ralph didn't hear the thick popping sound the fragile, flabby thing made when it burst, but he could imagine it. Was helpless not to, it seemed, and he could imagine its innards dripping down her nylon leg like pus. It would remain there at least until her evening shower, unseen, unfelt, unsuspected. Now the two of them began discussing how they should cover the scheduled pro-life rally this afternoon, assuming it actually happened, that was. The woman was of the opinion that not even the Friends of Life would be dumb-headed enough to show up at the Civic Center after what had happened at High Ridge. Kirkland told her it was impossible to underestimate the idiocy of fanatics. People who could wear that much polyester in public were clearly a force to be reckoned with. And all the time they were talking, exchanging quips and ideas and gossip, more of the swollen, multicolored bugs were swarming busily up their legs and torsos. One pioneer had made it all the way up to Kirkland's red tie and was apparently bound for his face. Movement off to the right caught Ralph's eye. He turned toward the doors in time to see one of the techs elbowing a buddy and pointing at him and Lois. Ralph suddenly had an all-too-clear picture of what they were seeing. Two people with no visible reason for being here,
Neither of them was wearing a black armband, and they were clearly not representatives of the media, just hanging out at the edge of the parking lot. The lady, who had already screamed once, had her face buried against the gentleman's arm, and the gentleman in question was gaping like a fool at nothing in particular. Ralph spoke softly and from the corner of his mouth, like an inmate discussing escape in an old Warner Brothers jailbreak epic. "Get your head up. We're attracting more attention than we can afford." For a moment, he really didn't believe she was going to be able to do that. And then she came through and lifted her head. She glanced at the shrubs growing along the wall one final time, an involuntary, horrified little peek, and then looked resolutely back at Ralph, and only Ralph. "Do you see any sign of Atropos, Ralph? That is why we're here, isn't it? To pick up his trail?" "Maybe, I suppose. Haven't even looked, to tell the truth. Too many other things going on." "I think we ought to get a little closer to the building." This wasn't a thing he wanted to do, but it seemed very important to do something. He could feel the death bag all around them, a gloomy, suffocating presence that was passively opposed to forward motion of any kind. That was what they had to fight. "All right," she said. "I'm going to ask for Connie Chung's autograph, and I'm going to be all giggly and silly while I do it. Can you stand that?" "Yes." "Good, because that will mean that if they're looking at anybody, they'll be looking at me."
"Sounds good."
He spared one last look at John Kirkland and the woman producer. They were now discussing what events might cause them to break into the evening's network feed and go live, totally unaware of the lumbering trilobites crawling back and forth on their faces. One of them was currently squirming slowly into John Kirkland's mouth. Ralph looked away in a hurry and let Lois pull him over to where Miss Chung stood with Rosenberg, the bearded cameraman. He saw the two of them glance first at Lois and then at each other. The shared look was one part amusement and three parts resignation. Here comes one of them. And then Lois gave his hand a hard little squeeze that said, "Never mind me, Ralph. You take care of your business and I'll take care of mine."
"Pardon me, but aren't you Connie Chung?"
Lois asked in her gushiest, "isn't this the living end" voice.
"I saw you over there, and at first I said to Norton, 'Is that the lady who's on with Dan Rather? Or am I crazy?' And then..."
"I am Connie Chung, and it's very nice to meet you, but I'm getting ready for tonight's news, so if you could excuse me..."
"Oh, of course. I wouldn't dream of bothering you. I only want an autograph. Just a quick little scribble would do, because I'm your number one fan, at least in Maine."
Miss Chung glanced at Rosenberg. He was already holding a pen out in one hand, much as a good O.R. nurse has the instrument the doctor will want next, even before he calls for it. Ralph turned his attention to the area in front of the Civic Center and slid his perceptions up the tiniest bit. What he saw in front of the doors was a semi-transparent, blackish substance that puzzled him at first. It was about 2 inches deep and looked almost like some sort of geological formation. That couldn't be, though, could it? If what he was looking at was real, the way objects in the short-time world were real, at least, the stuff would have blocked the doors from opening, and it wasn't doing that. As Ralph watched, two TV techs strolled ankle-deep through the stuff, as if it were no more substantial than low-lying ground mist. Ralph remembered the oral footprints people left behind, the ones that looked like Arthur Murray learned to dance diagrams, and suddenly thought he understood. The tracks faded away like cigarette smoke. Except that cigarette smoke really didn't go away. It left a residue on walls, on windows, and in lungs. Apparently, human auras left their own residue. It probably wasn't enough to see once the colors faded if it was only one person, but this was the biggest public meeting place in Maine's fourth largest city. Ralph thought of all the people who had poured in and out through these doors. All the banquets, conventions, coin shows, concerts, basketball tourneys, and understood that semi-transparent slag. It was the equivalent of the slight dip you sometimes saw in the middle of much-used steps. Never mind that now, sweetheart. Take care of your business. Nearby, Connie Chung was scribbling her name on the back of Lois's light bill for September. Ralph looked at that slaggy residue on the cement apron in front of the doors, hunting for a trace of atropos. Something which might register more as smell than sight. A nasty, meaty aroma like the alley which used to run behind Mr. Houston's butcher shop when Ralph was a kid.
Thank you, Lois was burbling. I said to Norton, she looks just like she does on TV, just like a little china doll. Those were my exact words.
Very welcome, I'm sure, Chung said. But I really have to get back to work.
Of course you do. Say hello to Dan Rather for me, won't you? Tell him I said courage.
I certainly will, Chung smiled and nodded as she handed the pen back to Rosenberg. Now, if you'll excuse us.
If it's here, it's higher up than I am, Ralph thought. I'll have to slide up a little bit farther.
Yes, but he'd have to be careful, and not just because time had become an extremely valuable commodity. The simple fact was that if he went up too high, he would disappear from the short-time world, and that was the sort of occurrence which might even distract these news people from the impending pro-choice rally, at least for a while. Ralph concentrated, but when the painless spasm inside his head happened this time, it didn't come as a blink, but as the soft lowering of a lash. Color bloomed silently into the world. Everything stood forth with exclamatory brilliance. Yet the strongest of these colors, the oppressive key chord, was the black of the death bag, and it was a negation of all the others. Depression and that sense of debilitating weakness fell on him again, sinking into his heart like the pointed ends of a claw hammer. He realized that if he had business to do up here, he'd better do it quickly and scoot back down to the short-time level before he was stripped clean of life force. He looked at the doors again. For a moment, there was still nothing but the fading auras of short-timers like himself. And then, what he was looking for suddenly came clear, rising into his view as a message which has been written in lemon juice rises into sight when it is held close to a candle flame. He had expected something which would look and smell like the rotting guts in the bins behind Mr. Houston's knacker's shop. But the reality was even worse, possibly because it was so unexpected. There were fans of a bloody mucousy substance on the doors themselves, marks made by Atropos's restless fingers, perhaps, and a revoltingly large puddle of the same stuff sinking into the hardened residue in front of the doors. There was something so terrible about this stuff, so alien, that it made the color bugs look almost normal by comparison. It was like a pool of vomit left by a dog suffering from some new and dangerous strain of rabies. A trail of this stuff led away from the puddle, first in drying clots and splashes, then in smaller drips like spilled paint. Of course, Ralph thought. That's why we had to come here. The little bastard can't stay away from the place. It's like cocaine to a dope addict. He could imagine Atropos standing right here where he, Ralph, was standing now, looking, grinning, then stepping forward and putting his hands on the doors, caressing them, creating those filthy, filmy marks. Could imagine Atropos drawing strength and energy from the very blackness which was robbing Ralph of his own vitality. He has other places to go. And other things to do, of course. Every day is undoubtedly a busy day when you're a supernatural psycho like him. But it must be hard for him to stay away from this place for long, no matter how busy he is. And how does it make him feel? Like a tight fuck on a summer afternoon, that's how. Lois tugged his sleeve from behind and he turned to her. She was still smiling, but the feverish intensity in her eyes made the expression on her lips look suspiciously like a scream. Behind her, Connie Chung and Rosenberg were strolling back toward the building.
You've got to get me out of here, Lois whispered. I can't stand it anymore. I feel like I'm losing my mind.
Okay, no problem.
I can't hear you, Ralph, and I think I can see the sun shining through you. Jesus, I'm sure I can.
Oh, wait. He concentrated and felt the world slide slightly around him, The colors faded. Lois's aura seemed to disappear back inside her skin. Better?
Well, solider, anyway. He smiled briefly.
Good, come on. He took her by the elbow and began guiding her back toward where Joe Weiser had dropped them off. It was the same direction in which the bloody splashes led.
Did you find what you were looking for?
Yes. She brightened at once.
That's great.
I saw you go up, you know. It was very odd. Like watching you turn into a sepia-toned photograph. And then, thinking I could see the sun shining through you. That was very peculiar. She looked at him severely.
Bad, huh?
No, not bad exactly, just peculiar. Those bugs now, they were bad.
Ugh!
I know what you mean, but I think they're all back there.
Maybe, but we're still a long way from being out of the woods, aren't we?
Yeah, a long way from Eden, Carol would have said.
Just stick with me, Ralph Roberts, and don't get lost.
Ralph Roberts? Never heard of him. Norton's the name. And that, he was happy to see, made her laugh.